CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Remind you always, you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us on the web at taylor-report.com. Today, we're going to be talking about the war clouds developing in the Middle East, particularly around Syria, and the drum beating that's going on in what passes for media here. I could give you a sample. There's a headline I saw on the Star that said, stars in alignment against Syria. And I think they meant, I thought there was a typo, they meant star in alignment because all their writers are ready to go. They've passed out the helmets and the tear gas, and they're ready to rationalize just about anything. The expert we will go to is truly an expert, knows what he's talking about, travels in the region, doesn't want to see those people go to war. And that is Zafar Ben-Gash. By the way, he spoke in Hamilton last week, a couple of weeks ago, actually. Well, I might ask him about that. I was very pleased to hear that the peace organizations that sponsored that had a full house. And matter of fact, standing room only for people. And we're going to talk some about black history. And to us, it's an occasion. There used to be in the 20th century, long, long ago, they used to say the question. And it is a question. Racism, particularly in North America, but all over Europe, is virulent. And it is a question how to deal with the fact of oppression, racial oppression, both in terms of what's been accomplished, what might be accomplished. So we're going to talk about that some. And we might touch on the NDP debates, etc. But I'm going to begin by apologizing for a rather hasty reading of a text last week, because I think it deserves more attention than I gave it, or a little more careful attention. And I was reading from I'm looking at the title, the Selected Writings of William Lyon Mackenzie, which was put together by Margaret Fairley. And I don't know that the book is widely available. By the way, a big contribution to Canadian publishing would be to republish this book. It's an excellent book, and I don't know why we have statues of people like Mackenzie if we're not going to make his writings available so that people can appreciate who he was and what he was trying to accomplish, because he was rather remarkable and in some ways fabulous character. And I notice the tradition, by the way. Oh, and Phil Conlon's here. I haven't called attention to that. How you doing, Phil?
Hi, Phil. I'm good.
I noticed he was reading. I didn't want to interrupt, but what the heck.
Well, I found the document I'm looking for.
Pardon me?
I found the obituary I was looking for.
He's looking.
So that's for Black History Month. So.
Yeah, good. Well, we got that, too. And one thing about William Lyon Mackenzie, and this is apropos of Black History Month, we're getting to that, is that I noticed that there's a terrible cliche that you can't say his name without calling him fiery. There was a fiery William Lyon Mackenzie, fiery, and they like to say fiery Scott. I thought that, of course, that's redundant, that you don't really need to add that. Okay, now look, here's what it is. In 1834, in his paper, which really livened up Upper Canada, or Canada, province of Canada, British province, in 1834, he dealt with a matter that is involves mythology about the rights and freedoms of black people who had come to Canada and with the conditions they were living under. And so in 1834, he wrote the following. This is something I didn't read last week, but I'm going to add this in. And this is his report. One day last summer, a poor black girl who had escaped from the whiplash to this side of the water was seized on a Sunday near Queenston in broad daylight between 11 and noon by two hired scoundrels who hauled and pulled her through that village, she screaming and crying in the most piteous and heartrending manner, and the ruffian, cream-colored tormentors laughing at her distress. and amusing the villagers with a cock and bull story. That's why they call him Fiery. With a cock and bull story that she has stolen $500 and that the money had been found in her bundle, to the everlasting disgrace of the inhabitants of Queenston, they stood by, many of them, and allowed the poor African lass to be placed by main force on board the ferry boat, which was to carry her back into slavery of a far worse nature than she had formerly experienced. Her lot would now be, first, exemplary punishment, and second, a slow murder, for so it may be called, in the unhealthy climate of the rice or sugar plantations. Is it not time that kidnapping of this sort in Upper Canada were put an end to by the strong arm of the law? I think he posed a pretty good question. That's William Lyon Mackenzie writing in 1834. Now, second article, the one I read last week, but I'm going to make sure I read it properly and clearly and because it's important for our history. This is from 1837, his paper, The Constitution. The title is, the headline was, Slaughter of Negroes at Niagara. We have been informed that the town of Niagara was much disturbed on Friday last in consequence of an order having arrived there from His Excellency, the Lieutenant Governor, to the Sheriff to give up a colored man of the name of Mosby to the authorities from the state of Kentucky, who, it is said, effected his escape from thence in April last, and as they could not claim him as a slave, they procured an order from the authorities of that state to Sir Francis Head to surrender him as a horse thief. The deputy sheriff, accompanied by a number of constables and soldiers, proceeded to carry the peremptory orders to His Excellency into effect and to deliver the unfortunate man up to the authorities when a numerous body of colored people appeared apparently to prevent the execution of the order. As soon as Mosby was taken outside the jail gate, we are informed, he dragged himself from his irons and, jumping from the wagon in which he was placed, escaped. When the deputy sheriff ordered the soldiers and constables to fire, and the result was that two colored men were shot dead and several wounded. That's from the Constitution, 20 September, 1837. Now, he has a second item. I think this is like his comment or editorial of William Lyon Mackenzie. Mosby was doomed by law to perpetual slavery in Kentucky. His master might buy and sell and torture him, not because he was a criminal, but because his complexion was dark. Mosby sighed after liberty, and they say he mounted his tyrant's horse and sought a home and freedom in Upper Canada. This is his crime with Sir Francis. Mosby's master sought him here, applied to a kindred spirit in Sir Francis Bond Head for authority to take him back. The benevolent people of Niagara prayed that he might not be sent back, to meet, no doubt, a terrible fate as an example to others. The sons of Africa, sons of African misery. Sir Francis, that would be the Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada, Sir Francis received both applications, ordered the slave back to Kentucky. The Niagara sheriff got the inhuman order, did his utmost to fulfill it, but the citizens would not assist him. They were horror-struck. Sir Francis has decided that for a slave whose forefathers were dragged from Africa, put in irons, placed under the cruel lash of the Negro drivers, and perhaps whipped or worked to death, that for this slave to mount a horse and seek his liberty in Canada is a dreadful crime. That the brave young slave is a felon, a guilty felon, and that he must be sent back to Kentucky, a place where those of his color are looked on as being on a level with the beasts of burden. If this be guilt, then would we be guilty of a like offense, if under the circumstances Mosby was placed in. The two men killed while helping Mosby, I think this is the editor, Margaret Fairley, making the point, the two men killed while helping Mosby to escape were Herbert Holmes and Jacob Green. See the report of the coroner's inquest in the Constitution for October 1837. And this is published in the Constitution 27 September 1837. So, being an admirer of William Lyon Mackenzie, I saw the coroner's report. I read the Constitution. It's not in the selected writings, so I can share with you my discoveries and findings. It's very interesting. Let's review that a slave owner in Kentucky wanted his slave back. The slave had ridden out of the off the plantation using his master's horse. But you see, we were wonderful, British, et cetera. We were against slavery. So we couldn't return him as a slave. However, we could return him as a horse thief. So you see, our hands are clean. This is a wonderful system, and that's why we're all together and love each other so much. We're all so principled. We definitely cannot return him as a slave. However, since you told us he's a horse thief, and if you remember the first piece I read about the poor young woman, described as a girl, probably a sub-teen, she, they said, had stolen $500. Well, that's good enough. They claim she stole something, so she has to go back. So now what I was struck by, and the reason I'm doing this, I want to see a monument to, I want to answer the question, where's Mosby? He escaped. Thanks to the intervention of at least, according to the coroner's inquest, what he said happened was that they got the order to take him back to Kentucky, and they wanted to obey the order, but he said, we looked out the window, and there was a crowd of colored men holding clubs, and some of them had dirks, D-I-R-K-S. I think that's a little knife. Maybe it's a big one, but at any rate, dirks. So he said, we had a meeting, and we said, maybe we shouldn't go out. And he said, well, we got to go out. We got orders. We got to take him and return him to his master. And so he said they started out, but they said the colored men wouldn't. He said, I read them the riot act, but he said they just stood and looked at me. So he said, I told them, you got to go away. And he said they wouldn't go away. So we had another meeting. And he said, I think we probably ought to forget it. But he said, no, the other officer said, we have orders, so let's carry them out. So he said, well, if you're going to do that, you better bring soldiers. And the crowd remained outside. So they went and got four soldiers with guns who came. And they said, now you clear away. And the crowd refused to clear away. So they tried to force their way. And there was a fight. And two black men, their names Herbert Holmes and I'm going to have to remember the other guy's name. Herbert Holmes and the second man, Jacob Green, pardon me, Holmes and Green were shot dead. Two other colored men, as the paper said, were wounded. And one soldier was stabbed in the arm by a dirk. Someone with a dirk got him. And Mosby escaped. So this is the Taylor Report. We're asking 89.5 FM, CIUT. We want to know what happened to Mosby. To me, that is one of the great Canadian stories. They tried to get him. A crowd of black Canadians were not going to allow a slave to be re-enslaved, escape slave. So they intervened with their own muscle and hands. It wasn't any nice white governor from Britain. That white governor, wanted Mosby to go back. So let's be very clear. It took it was the black population of that village in Niagara, September 1837, they're the ones who saved Mosby's life. However, as often happens in struggles involving courage and physical courage, two of them were killed. So I want to know, and we're going to work on this at the Taylor Report, what happened to Mosby? He's a great Canadian story. He deserved to be remembered. Now, the Toronto Star over the weekend said Toronto should remember and name a street after our first black postman. I agree. Why not? Absolutely. First black postman. That's important. But isn't it kind of important to remember the two black Canadians who had intervened with their bodies to keep a man from being shipped by the British to back into slavery in the American South? Where's their monument? Where is their memorial? I'd say I don't want a street named after him. I want a monument. I want half the town named after him. And we need to know about Mosby. By the way, we would not know any of this if Margaret Fairley hadn't published a book with the selected writings of William Lyon Mackenzie, because everybody's so much in the mode of self-congratulation. What a wonderful, different kind of place this is. If it hadn't been for black Canadians, Mosby would have been shipped. And according to the writings of William Lyon Mackenzie, this was common. When I read additional material about what was going on there in Niagara, he says there are a lot of paid spies who work for slave catchers who keep an eye out for people that they think are likely, and then they capture them. And I think everybody understands or should know, according to the law, I mean, all it took was the word of the owner, and you were finished. Your word counted for nothing. Mosby spoke for himself, by the way. He told them, I'm a free man. I haven't done anything wrong. And this is in the coroner's inquest. He said he told us he was a free man and that he said we had our orders. Does that sound familiar to me? We all know the 20th century horrors of states seizing people and saying they don't have rights and transferring them and all those things. So that all went on. And I'm making this into a little cause. You know, previously we did the library cause. We thought it was important. We want a historical reenactment of that period in 1813 when the Admiral of the U.S. Navy apologized to the Toronto librarians that some of his men had stolen books. And we want a historical reenactment because he got a ship under a flag of truce to return two boxes of stolen books with his apologies. And the two words that stood out were he was mortified to find out that his men had stolen them. And two, he thought that everybody understood that a library is a sacred institution. So we want a historical reenactment of that. And we'd like to see, but we're going to work on Mosby. His name was Solomon Mosby, by the way. At the time of his article, Mackenzie didn't know, but I found it in the coroner's inquest. The coroner said there was this man. His name was Solomon Mosby. So I don't want to get Solomon Mosby in trouble. And I don't want him to see him shipped back. I know that the Harper government would entertain a request by the Obama administration.
In a heartbeat. Actually.
And I know that
horse thieves.
And
no
Obama
mercy.
And Hay would agree that neither one of them likes racism, and both are opposed to slavery. But you know, the man did steal a horse. Yeah. I mean, let's get to it. And the law has to be obeyed. If that means killing two black men who get in the way, well, black Canadians, well, we'll do it. That was the name of that song. Anyway, so that's I hope I have.
Phil, can I ask you a question about that flag of truce? Explain to me something about military etiquette. Once the guys come over.
It used to exist.
Yeah, well, I mean, could you do that now? Could you,
flag of truce.
Go with a flag of truce and expect that they're going to, thank you very much for the books. Now you can take your ship and go back. This sounds a little far-fetched, actually, according to the way wars are fought now, no?
They were far more, they tended to be more observant of the laws, actually. But we have a new barbarian system. Mm. I've complained about that on this program. There are people writing about it. We had a guest on the program, a historian from out west, you remember, talked about the militarization. I agree on two fronts. One, we have militarization of our culture going on like a wildfire, and everybody seems quite happy with it, I think because they're intimidated. The whole idea is to intimidate people, in my opinion. But the other is the barbarization of the military. When I served, we had to take oaths and everything, and actually we took them seriously. And at least I did. I thought it was. And so... There is an etiquette between combatants. By the way, I mean that's why people who are not combatants who choose to become combatants are fair game. I mean, people who have no legal order, no identifying uniform, no clear purpose, because wars have purposes. Say we want this and you want that, and I guess there's going to have to be a fight about it. But if you have freelance people, that can lead to all kinds of ugly consequences, such as we see in Syria today, which is why the press chooses to focus on the Syrian army, which actually is under some kinds of conventions about command structure and orders and who gave the orders and what's the mission. They choose not to talk about the people who are committing all the mayhem. The United Nations supported the barbarians in that they said, well, the army should stand down, get out of the way, leaving the door open to people with no sworn adherence to Geneva Conventions or any other international law. They are, in that sense, mere outlaws. But our culture has drifted into it loving outlaws, and we celebrate them in the military. These guys with tattoos about how they're going to kill this race or that race, or how much they like Hitler, or all this stuff. And we just had this photograph. You saw it, and probably Phil, of the special elite. By the way, they always use the word elite. I can tell you from being in the military, we hate the word elite. Anybody in the military, it's an insult to whatever you're doing. Is it? In other words, you're just less important. And these elite snipers had a German fascist symbol in the middle of their photograph. They're wearing American Army uniforms, and they're all posing with their high-powered rifles with the scopes. That's decadence. That's decadence within the military. They don't quite realize it. And when someone who is a soldier, you join, and they say, well, these are the rules. You'll obey the rules. And we're a lawful country, and we don't violate the laws of war, etc. And then the next thing you know, the guy who did that, took those steps, is called a warrior. You're getting confused. You're actually a soldier. And you have certain legal responsibilities, and you swear an oath to obey those things. And if you start talking about a warrior, you're actually moving into other territory, which is not part of the nomenclature of organized military. So when I was associated, and I know people all the way back, I knew people who fought in several wars, and I knew some who committed some crimes too, by the way, they were under law. They didn't use the word warrior. That's a new word, and it's come mainly from people like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and others who are not warriors, but they're movie stars who play warriors. And another problem we're having is we actually mistake John Wayne for a Marine when he didn't serve in the war. And the men who did, they don't get any say because old John is the one who knows how to look into a camera. You know, John knows, you know, the angle for the shot to make him look brave, when in fact he wasn't brave. My favorite John Wayne story, I'm going to digress. My favorite John Wayne story is that he had a lovely Mexican-American wife, and they were very noted, you know, handsome John and her, and the passionate affair. We all read about it. Anyway, she walked off on him, and it was an ugly divorce. And a reporter was there when John Wayne was listening to the evidence of her relations with another man, and he said he threw up. That was John Wayne. I don't think it would have been good to get a close-up of that. Anyway, so we're on the subject. No. Flag of truce? I think they do sometimes get a flag of truce. But the other warriors. I think in Afghanistan they get a flag of truce once in a while between Afghans. Or people like Turks and Kurds or something. Once in a while you probably get a flag of truce. I'm not hearing much about it otherwise. Let's see. I would remind you, we're going to be talking to Zafar Bengash. I recommend, I hope everybody's following Global Research. They're on top of this matter. So we had Steve Gowans on last week. He has an excellent article on Syria. I think our timing was great. I think we interviewed him one day, and his article appeared the next. So we got the article before the readers did. And there's a site, too, that I want to recommend, and apropos of this developing crisis in the Middle East, about which we're going to ask Zafar Bengash, is a site called the humanitarianwar.com. And that's, we've referred to it before, I want to remind you, the humanitarianwar.com. These guys are brilliant. And they interview one of the human rights NGO experts who appeared before the United Nations and gave them a cock and bull story, as Mackenzie would say, about how bad Gaddafi was. And they, through their interview, they revealed that he didn't actually know very much. Other than being a kind of a double for Peter Lorre, there wasn't anything to him. But you can watch it, and it'll make your skin crawl, because you say, this creep sat there at the United Nations and spoke in such a way as to permit open, you know, for NATO to open the bomb bay doors and bombs away on Libya. That character did that. So humanitarianwar.com, of course, in Global Research, and Stephen Gowans, and the one you really need always is stopwar.com. That's Rick Razov, whom we've had on this program. And he's following all this, and you go to Rick Razov, stopwar.com, and you get 8-10 articles which are very well selected, informing you about the forces that are at work here at the moment in the Middle East. And so forewarned is forearmed. And I have one that I like very much. I've got to read you a headline. You're not going to see this, by the way, in Onion. Onion is a – you ever read Onion, Phil?
I do.
They're really sharp characters.
They are.
Probably sometimes a little too sharp for their own good. But on their website, I go to the Onion, and I found this great headline with a photograph. It's a photograph of a missile in a silo, and the headline reads, Iran worried U.S. might be building 8,500th nuclear weapon. They think that U.S. is closing in on having 8,500 nuclear weapons, and this could be a problem. And Onion ran that on the front page. I thought that's brilliant. And because, as we know, Iran doesn't actually have a nuclear weapon, but the United States has 8,499, and they want to talk about people having them. Now, one of the reasons I bring it up is there is a print version appears in Canada, The Onion, and that one wasn't in it. And I thought this was one of their smartest moments, but the editors seem to think maybe they shouldn't go with that one. That's my guess. They're happy. By the way, I'd be happy to be corrected if I am mistaken. Another matter I want to call to our listeners' attention is the website, which I refer to off and on, called The Angry Arab, and very smart fellow. And if you go to The Angry Arab, you can find on Sunday the 12th, a video ready to go, a 38-minute speech at the United Nations by Walid Khalidi on the story of Jerusalem, how this has become a matter of serious dispute between the West and the Palestinian population. But it is powerful, and it's very brilliant, and it's just readily accessible. So I think people, if you get a chance to look at it, please do. And today's Counterpunch has a great piece by Diana Johnson. And Phil, you have something from that article.
I do, and then I have a little announcement about an important event this week, which I did find on the
Make a little announcement
workers.
And
okay.
Share with us
okay,
Diana
the,
Johnson.
Okay, we'll do the announcement first. Family Day Action to Demand Justice for Migrant Farm Worker Deaths. And there's going to be a rally this week, Friday, February 17th at noon, at the office of the Chief Coroner. Speaking of coroner's reports, here's one going on now. And it'll be followed by a march to the Ministry of Labor. And basically, this is over the fact that there were recently concluded some legal proceedings against a farm corporation in southwestern Ontario for some violations of health and safety practices, which led to the death of two Jamaican migrant workers. When we call them migrant workers, we mean they're here on restricted visas. They come, they work, then they have to leave, right?
Oh.
These guys didn't get to leave, right? And the prosecutor in this case, although he had solid evidence to prosecute the bosses of this farm and the corporation itself, then the prosecution took a dive, made a little small plea bargain. One guy got one small fine. They said it's one of the smallest fines they've ever seen, as befits the death of two migrants.
Well, they're
right?
embarrassed, you see. Yeah. I mean, the main thing is that they're embarrassed.
And yeah.
Isn't that
course,
punishment enough?
Terrible for the farmers. So there'll be a rally put on by by who is it? There's a Migrante, which is a an organization that that agitates for the rights of migrant workers, and that's Friday, February 17th, 12 noon, at the office of the chief coroner at 32 Granville Street.
Yeah. Before I have to, because we're going to be going to Saffron Freedom. Mm-hmm. I want to. This is editing on air, folks. Yeah. This is Taylor Report, by the way, CIUT 89.5 FM, and. I just want to, because we're going to have Zafar coming up, but maybe we'll do the Giant Johnson at the end of the program. We probably have about 5-10 minutes. So I just want to call attention to this, how dangerous our print media can be. I mean, they are really, Theodore Dreiser, I quote him every once in a while, he said, we don't need freedom of the press, we need freedom from it. And the Internet has given us freedom from it. Mm. And we really have to be protected because people are paid to write things, and if they don't write them, they don't get paid, is the way how you might put it. So I read a column in the Toronto Star, and an otherwise previously sane writer is sharing his enthusiasm for the armed groups against the Assad government, and he wants to paint a little picture for us. So he says, before we get to the main things, he says, I want you to meet... Hassan Hashimi, a Syrian-Canadian, the Toronto area architect, is an exile from the Assad regime. Came here in 1996 from Saudi Arabia, where his father, an academic, fled in 1979 to escape the brutalities of Assad's father, President Assad Hassan. Okay, good for him. Is he aware that Saudi Arabia is a brutal dictatorship? How do you get your
somebody
mind around
somebody who escapes
that?
From Syria to the Saudis?
Yes, let's see. Now, for example, there are almost 1 million Christian refugees from the American bombing of Iraq and attacks on it. They fled into Syria. There's almost 1 million of them living as protected refugees in Syria. There are no Christian churches allowed, let alone refugees in Saudi Arabia. But he fled to that place because, you see, he wanted to get away from the brutalities. There was a woman who was convicted in last year, December, of witchcraft. She was publicly beheaded. And the guy who does the beheading there was quite proud of his work. He says, sometimes I hit them so quick and strong that the head rolls 3 or 4 feet. This was a woman. The crime was witchcraft. And so... she got it. Now, nobody said, well, that's the time to break relations or that's the time to support armed rebels. No. I have to say, look, if you went to Saudi Arabia and you're comfortable there, pal, you like repression. You eat it up. That's your breakfast. That's what you really like. You like repression. That's why you went there. So, anyway, we're going to take a quick break. This is Taylor Report, and we'll see you on the other side.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
I said we'd be back. This is the Taylor Report. Write to us, Taylor. Taylor@CIUT.FM, and check us out, Taylor-Report.com. And I think we are joined by Zafar Benkash. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very good. Listen, congratulations. You spoke in Hamilton recently, and I heard it was standing room only. Is that true?
That's correct, yes. We had the packed hall and about at least 50 or 60 people standing because there are no seats. So it was a very exciting meeting, and it generated quite a bit of heat as well. But I think that's what life is all about.
Great. Well, Ed, well, you're designed for this. I know that. And
thank you.
I'm very encouraged, Zafar, because in the first half of this program, we talk about this. The war drums are being beaten rather heavily. And
yes.
There's something called the NDP debate, which apparently they've agreed not to debate, but they do debate. And no one talks about something which is very dangerous. And so the fact that people come out and fill halls to hear you talk and warn them against the threat of war and against sanctions and against this belligerent attitude, the Western powers, with their Gulf state friends. It needs airing out. I think the Canadian people, based on Occupy Wall Street, they seem to be awake. I don't think they're asleep. They're being treated as if they're asleep, but they're not.
That's correct. I think you touched a very important point. When we have an official opposition party and one that claims to speak on behalf of the little guy, the poor man, and yet when it maintains such deafening silence, particularly during a leadership contest, unfortunately, it doesn't reflect too well on that party. And
it doesn't say very much for our political culture.
Exactly.
That
exactly.
People say, well, why can't we just cut to the chase? Do you think that there should be a war with Iran? Do you think we should be arming rebels in Syria?
Yes, all kinds of terrible things are going on, and unfortunately, the NDP is missing in action. It is not there when we are expecting them to speak on behalf of these issues. But it seems to me that they are trying to keep a head low when, in fact, the people of Canada voted for them and brought them to this position precisely because they felt that there was a party that spoke on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And as you said in your earlier remarks, that today, whenever there is a program with respect to no war on Iran, and you have halls being packed with people and people standing in the hall, coming out in such large numbers, obviously indicates that there is a great deal of interest as well as concern among Canadians that there shouldn't be another march to war as there was on Iraq and Afghanistan and the mess that they have created over there. And now they are beating the drums of war against Iran. So obviously, it is very disturbing that the major political parties are maintaining either total silence or, in the case of the conservatives, marching lockstep and barrel with the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that the conservatives, even when the liberals had opted out of the war against Iraq, Stephen Harper, who was at that time the leader of the opposition, he condemned that. He said that Canada should have gone to war against Iraq. And yet now that he's the prime minister, he wants to take Canada into another war, disastrous war, that if it should come to pass, would be launched on a pack of lies as it was done against Iraq, and no doubt with even greater negative consequences. And I can tell you something, that let's say the Americans and the Israelis, of course, who are the ones pushing this, and the Canadian government, if they were to be involved in this illegal and immoral war, let me tell you something. Canadians had better be prepared for the fact that there would be the price of gas is going to skyrocket. There'll be huge lineups at gas stations, and I can even foresee people fighting with each other to get gas into their cars. So I think we really ought to take this issue very seriously and not be pushed into a completely illegal and immoral war, which has absolutely no basis whatsoever at all.
Yes. And that's, you know, they were being, I wanted you to speak to this issue of how basically the great powers manipulate the institutions in order to cause bad things to happen. For example, going forward with a resolution which was not acceptable, it was not going to work. It was known that Russia and China would say, you cannot interfere in the internal affairs of another country. You can't call up for someone to step down. That's not the job of the United Nations. And
exactly.
if you're concerned about violence, you have to call on end of violence on both sides. You cannot say to the government, you stop. How could they possibly? I mean, but they pushed it anyway so that they could say, well, look at that. The Russians stopped. And then I want to an aspect of that. They say, well, you see, the United Nations almost decided, and Syria is isolated. But I was looking at, as I understand the map, Lebanon doesn't agree with ordering Assad to step down. Iraq definitely does not agree. Of course, there's Algeria and other states. And having, you know, Russia and China are not actually small countries, the last I heard.
That's true.
Maybe we should explain
also,
that.
China is also there. So it's not really a very small country, is
we
it?
Should probably ask them to read Tolstoy. How do they get to this position? I mean, that resolution, what did you make of that resolution that they put forward?
Well, obviously, that resolution was pushed by the Arab League, which is, of course, made up of these remarkable democracies, you know. Each and every one of them is a sample of democracy ruled by dictators and tyrants. And they, you know, I mean, it's
they have perfect democracies.
Absolutely.
Because they're absolute monarch. They can't get better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They want democracy in every other country except their own. So that's how great they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, when Russia and China, for their reason, and for very good reasons, actually they had this experience in Libya. When they saw what happened in Libya and how the West manipulated that resolution, which was essentially a resolution to prevent Gaddafi's air force from bombing civilian areas, that basically turned into a free-for-all bombing of Libya. Its cities, its refineries, its schools, its hospitals, they were all targeted. And so essentially, that resolution was used as a pretext to go and destroy Libya, and now Libya is in a mess. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do the same thing in Syria. I want to emphasize that obviously Bashar al-Assad is not a democratically elected leader, but I think the people of Syria realize that if they were to go down the route that Libya has gone, they would be in deep difficulty. They would be in great trouble. And so in that sense, this attempt that was made by the U.S. and its allies to try to push that resolution to therefore interfere in Syrian affairs didn't work because both Russia and China were not prepared to go along with it this time. Particularly Russia, because Syria is the only base that they have in the Middle East from which they can exert some influence and keep America from taking over completely in that region. But I think we also need to understand that what is taking place in Syria ought to be looked at in the larger context of the Middle East and the U.S. Zionist project for the Middle East. And, of course, we know that Syria is part of the resistance front. And so the aim of the Americans and the Zionists is to try to undermine Syria, thereby undermining Hezbollah and Hamas, that are resisting Zionist barbarities in that region.
Yeah, in the New York Times, they carried a column by a former head of Mossad who said precisely those things, that once we get Syria out of the way, we can finish off Iran, basically.
Exactly.
I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, and the New York Times carried that. I mean, then you say, well, maybe we shouldn't be entertaining all this silliness about how much everybody likes the rebel demand for democracy in Syria. Clearly, that isn't what this is about.
That's correct, yes. In fact, this whole notion of democracy that they talk about is basically to hoodwink people in the West, in their own country. I mean, otherwise, you know, obviously, neither the U.S. nor Israel or Britain or France can go around telling their people that we are in the business of regime change and we want to make sure that we destroy another country. I mean, they're not going to say that. Yes. So what they say to their people is, oh, we are trying to promote democracy. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, most people would not oppose that.
Of course.
And they'll say, well, that's something different that we can go for. Whereas, in fact, the truth is that it is not democracy that after. It is basically regime change and to undermine the resistance front that exists in the region. I mean, mm-hmm. if they were really after democracy, I think maybe Saudi Arabia would be a good starting place. They were not concerned about democracy in Bahrain.
Yeah.
They're not concerned
you can,
about
of course,
democracy
yeah.
anymore in Libya either. They're not concerned about democracy in Jordan. So one begins to wonder whether it's a democracy project or is it really something else. And it is clear that it is something else that they're after.
It seems to be, by the way, they almost, I think this Naomi Klein has this theory about chaos. It seems to be a chaos approach. In other words, if they have chaos, the only boss is themselves. And then they say, well, we have to sort you folks out. Obviously, you can't get it together. You're all failed. You failed your state. Therefore, we will be the state and handle matters. And now, a columnist in the Toronto Star on the weekend, he wrote very candidly, this guy used to work for Al Jazeera, he said, well, we're going to need a corridor, and it's already being discussed. And as though we, the reader, you know, we're all in on this. Sure, the answer would be a corridor from Turkey into Syria, and he actually with a straight face said, to deliver humanitarian goods.
Yes.
Actually, let me help him out. That's war.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, they're talking about as if, you know, that's the only way that they can operate, that they can get foreign forces to come and you know, interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, and now they are pushing Turkey to do that. And I think it's a very, very sad kind of a situation that they're pushing Turkey into. And I'll be very honest. I'm personally very disappointed because I had very high hopes of Turkey a few years ago. I thought they were on the right track, but it seems to me that they are also essentially playing real politic, and they are not really taking either a moral or a correct political position, because what they will end up doing is to create more chaos for the region. So in that sense, I'm very, very concerned about the position that Turkey has made.
The forces that created the situation in Turkey that made you found hopeful, they were, seen to me, I was watching from outside, but they appeared to be motivated by a desire not to be a flunky for NATO, and also they were tired of being humiliated by the European Union, at whose door they keep knocking.
Yes.
And I thought the mood was, well, let's stop trying to join Europe, and let's also stop serving NATO. And so those forces must still be there, and they must be very unhappy.
Yes, they are. In fact, I was in Turkey a couple of weeks ago, and I found that among a large segment of the Turkish population, there was great unease of the manner in which whole policy was being conducted. In fact, a number of Turkish writers actually wrote about it, and they complained that Turkey has not really thought out its policy very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So at least that is a hopeful sign that at least there are people in Turkey that understand what the situation is, and how to conduct their affairs.
Yeah. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. Zafar, we're having a little trouble with our connection, so we're going to have to sign off, but we're really grateful, and you put your finger on all the problems we wanted to talk about.
Okay. Thank you very much, Phil.
Okay. Thank you, Zafar Bengash. Okay. Bye-bye. And that was Zafar Bengash. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Please do. Phil, we're going to have time for that Diane Johnson.
Right.
Some words from her. By the way, Counterpunch today, you can find this piece. But we have a segment, and Phil could read that, and we can probably talk about that a bit.
Okay, so the piece is by Diane Johnson. I think we've had her on the show.
Yeah.
And it's called Road to Damascus and On to Armageddon. And that's a question. And this is an excerpt that we thought that we would read. The storyline of dictators killing their own people is intended primarily to justify harsh Western measures against Syria. As in Bosnia, the media are arousing public indignation to force the U.S. government to do what it in fact is already doing, armed Muslim rebels all in the name of protecting civilians. Last December, U.S. National Security Advisor Tom Donilon said that the, quote, end of the Assad regime would constitute Iran's greatest setback in the region yet, a strategic blow that will further shift the balance of power in the region against Iran, unquote. The protection of civilians is not the only concern on the minds of U.S. officials. They do think of such things as the balance of power in between their prayer breakfasts and human rights speeches. However, concern with the balance of power is a luxury denied less virtuous powers such as Russia and China. Surely the shift in the balance of power in the region cannot be limited to a single country, Iran. It is meant to increase the power of Israel, of course, but also the United States and NATO, and to decrease the influence of Russia. Thrusting Syria into helpless chaos is part of the war against Iran, but it is also implicitly part of a drive to reduce the influence of Russia and eventually China. In short, the current campaign against Syria is clearly in preparation for an eventual future war against Iran, but also obscurely a form of long-term aggression against Russia and China. The recent Russian and Chinese veto in the Security Council was a polite attempt to put a brake on this process. The cause of the veto was the determination of the West to push through a resolution that would have demanded withdrawal of Syrian government forces from contested areas without taking into consideration the presence of armed rebel groups poised to take over. Where the Western Revolution called on the Assad regime to, quote, withdraw all Syrian military and armed forces from cities and towns and return them to their original home barracks, unquote, the Russians wished to add, quote, in conjunction with the end of attacks by armed groups against state institutions and quarters and towns, unquote. The purpose was to prevent armed groups from taking advantage of the vacuum to occupy evacuated areas, as had happened in similar circumstances in Yugoslavia during the 1990s. Western refusal to rein in armed rebels was followed by the Russian and Chinese veto on February the 4th.
Very good. By the way, she's Diane that Johnson. Is a, by the way, she had a great book about what happened in former Yugoslavia. She's right on top of that. And, of course, she covered the Libya matter. Counterpunches featured her writing, as they wisely should. And so you can find that in today's Counterpunch. I was speaking to Zafar there earlier about this matter, and I was citing a column. And I just want to read. What bothers me is the cavalier way people talk about war. They seem to think it's kind of like these games kids play, right? You go, or the ones we used to play in the street. You say bang, and a kid falls down. He's supposed to count to 20 or something. The real thing ain't like that. And so anyway, he's writing this column. He says there'll be a largely. In Syria, this means that the future direction of the current crisis, including how an inevitable post-Assad era will unfold, will largely be a Syrian project with minimum outside interference beyond military support to the insurgents. So it's minimum. We're just going to do the minimum except for the military side. We'll do the maximum on the military side. There will be this will be a good thing overall, even though it may sometimes be messy and unpredictable. Let me translate messy. That would be dead Syrians, a lot of dead Syrians.
Dead Iraqi Christians.
Yeah.
A million refugees, right? What happens to them in this kind of war?
Where are they going
to
go? Yeah. Now, you have this leading us in the democratic fight, the Gulf states, all the monarchies, but particularly Saudi Arabia. Wait, by the way, Phil, I don't know if you know this. There are 1 million Philippine workers.
We certainly do know about that. And actually, in the Filipino community, what happens to them in their daily lives in that part of the world is always on the front page.
I think obscene. But the other thing is, those are the 1 million, and they would be about 98% Christian. The government that's leading our charge against the secular government of Syria does not allow Christian churches or Christian worship. If you are a foreigner in the country and you want to participate and organize, you have to bring your passport and be approved. It has to be signed off on. So, you know, we need less malarkey about all this. And I didn't get in my sort of family question I wanted to get for Zafar, which is Harper maybe a closet Islamist? Is that what we got here? because we have Al-Qaeda today says they're all with the Syrian armed groups killing people in Homs and trying to seize power by violence. And then you have the Harper government. Then you have the king of Saudi Arabia. And then you have the lesser minions with their trillions. And this is there is no tolerance in this the leadership of this group. I mean, these are like the ones in from Benghazi. These are people who want religious persecution. That is not the majority of Muslims, by the way. But it is there are groups, just as we can see them on Sunday and various churches in the United States who think that their group rule everybody. And on Saudi Arabian television, perhaps Prime Minister Harper is unaware, on Saudi television, you can listen to a madman practically fulminating about what they're going to do to the Alawi minority of Syria when they get power. But nobody has any problem with that. This is, and instead, they get their paintbrush out and paint it good, pure. But actually, I mean, this is ugly, very ugly business. And, well, you got to, that's why, of course, we recommend people read Straight Goods and go to Global Research and arm yourself. But, you know, we need to, as we were saying about the NDP, and Phil, I don't know, did you see the NDP debates?
I didn't have the heart. I've been reading the position papers coming out, and they've really been depressing. There's just... maybe one candidate marginally has raised some good issues, but for the most part, the candidates that are said to be the front runners are all mouthing platitudes. They would fit right in with the European NATO Social Democratic parties
the NATO parties
happily will wage war on everybody these days, and it's
absolutely.
Unfortunately that's what it looks like.
I mean,
is going to come out of this
debate. I don't see an ounce of honest passion that they would make sure that the T's were crossed and the I's dotted. They're not for that. These are guys are going to go along, and I think to me is the subjective side of it. They seem to think that we're kind of dumb, that we get our news from them. If they want to know why people are bored and their eyes are glazing over, is in the back of their minds they're thinking a nuclear contest involving Iran. A civil war in Syria, intervention by Turkey, NATO's threats. This is, people are turning that over in their minds. And they would think, wouldn't it be great if we had a government, you know, that looked out for us and said, the way you do that is to say, we're going to take each step very carefully. We want to know what everybody's doing here, and we don't want to see violence. But actually, we're in the nod, nod, wink, wink, elbow, elbow. We're going to do this, and you guys are going to go along. And you can tell from that NDP debate, yes, sir. They're going to go along. But I think that with the Occupy movement, people are awake. You know, some people kind of move around through a house or a building thinking everybody's asleep. They're not asleep. And in the middle of the 19th century across North America, including Canada, there were political people who got together and called themselves the Wide Awakes. They said, no, no, we're awake and we want to know something. They have power. They took the power to themselves. You're going to have to start answering questions. You know, we want to know how come all these rich people have everything. We are getting less and less and less. And then on top of that, you want us to take guns and go harm somebody else. No, no, no. We're wide awake now, and we want some answers. So to me, that's what's happening. And these guys, you know, Jack was a nice meteor. It flew through the sky. He's gone. They all think, now we're going to go back to what we were doing. Not that he would have. We don't know what would have happened to him. And that's the thing about people who, you know, temporary leadership and unfortunate, we don't know. However, if they think that they're going to dictate the agenda and tell us what the issues are, they're kidding themselves. And if the Toronto Star and others think that they can just, you know, sell us all, oh, yeah, it'd be a great idea if Turkey opens a corridor into Syria as a good deed, when the rest of us know that that's war and that there will be ugly consequences. Again, I think they're making a big mistake. So, again, I'll just remind you, listening to the Taylor Report, check out the Angry Arab and listen to Walid Khalidi explain the issue of Jerusalem. If you wondered about that, why it's so important and what it has to do with the Palestinian statehood issue, check it out. It's very good. I want to thank Carol, and I want to thank Phil Conlon, and I want to tell you again, this is the Taylor Report. Please write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And, of course, we're on the web at taylor-report.com. And check out Stephen Gowan's global research, stopwar.com, and a site called thehumanitarianwar.com. And you be thrice armed. And let's find out what happened to poor old Mosby. We're going to stay on that case for Black History Month. This is Phil Taylor, Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week.